This show is for educational purposes only and is not personalized advice. Consult your tax advisor before taking action. All investments involve risk of loss. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Read show notes for full disclosure.
Welcome to the Physician Family Financial Advisors podcast, where physician moms and dads like you can turn today's worries about taxes and investing into all the money you need for retirement and college.
Hello, physician moms and dads. I am Nate Reneke, certified financial planner and primary advisor here at Physician Family.
And I'm Ben Utley, certified financial planner and service team leader here at Physician Family.
Today, we have more questions from clients and listeners. So, Ben, I'm going to start us off with a question from a dermatologist out in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
They said that they're going to move in a year, and they asked, should I stop contributing to my taxable account in 529s if we're going to move?
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what's behind that, like why you would stop.
Right. Yeah. I think a lot of people are nervous these days about interest rates. So they're kind of going all in on getting big down payments. And, you know, my answer to this question assumes that you have an emergency fund and you're sort of set up to actually be ready to invest in the first place in a taxable account.
Right.
Moving into a second house, you should have some equity in your old house.
Right.
So part of it is this interest rate thing, large interest rates versus like houses that people have been in for several years. They've had really low interest rates. But the reality is, I don't think you should stop saving.
Yeah.
There's this big thought about saving on, a little bit here and there. Because if you're saving into a taxable account in 529s, there's so many good tax breaks and tax benefits to doing those things and staying on track. I hate to see people show up to a new house and then be behind on all their goals.
Yeah, I could see, I guess one of the questions I would have for the listener is, what does your plan say first? Because we always go back to the plan. Second is it necessary to stop saving for these other goals in order to actually be able to buy the house?
Mm-hmm.
For example, maybe they want to make a large, an all cash offer, right? Mm-hmm. So that'd be one scenario. But if they're, if they're slipping into this with a doctor loan or a 20% down and they've got the cash and their emergency fund is filled, I don't see any reason at all to stop investing in a taxable account or a 529 account. In fact, if the house is a planned expense, it should be part of the plan.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't see any reason to derail savings if it's part of the plan and everything's in the plan, right? And if it's not the plan, the question I ask, why isn't it in the plan?
Right. Yeah. So. And there's always sort of an escape route here. Getting your hands on money in a taxable account while you don't want to, because that derails your plans, it's possible.
Yeah.
And it's sort of the same for 529s. People keep their hands off of it, and I encourage them to keep their hands off of it. But if you stick $10,000 in a 529, you pull it out the next day, there's no taxes or penalties unless it went up.
Yeah.
So, it's pretty... generally, don't stop saving.
Yeah, and I would say don't tap your emergency fund to buy your house. We've seen disaster happen with that in the past. So
absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Next question.
So how much can we contribute to our grandchildren's 529s account without going over the gift limit?
Kind of depends on how many grandchildren, huh?
Right. Yeah, I guess. So the way the gift limits work, I'm the college planning specialist. So I talk about these gift limits a lot. And everyone sees the gift limit in 2024, it's $18,000.
Mm-hmm.
And each person, so if you have a spouse, two people can give $18,000 to one child, 36 grand.
Right.
And so they sort of think that's the most we can give. Mm-hmm. But 529s have a special rule where you can do a lump sum contribution. And you can spread out that gift over 5 years. They call it 5-year forward averaging.
Right.
So the answer is actually with two people giving a gift to one grandchild is $180,000.
Wow.
So this is the cool part. This is what I found because this is a client of ours, and I wrote their plan for their grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even need $180,000 to cover in-state public school.
Right. Yeah. It's probably on like $20,000 or $30,000 less than that, right?
Exactly. I think it was like $125,000. Depends on the age of the grandchild, but
and the state.
Yeah, and the state. But you know, I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, I know that's a lot, $120,000, but
yeah,
that they could squeeze all the money in and just be done.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and if, you know, if you want to do more than that, then some people think that if you do more than that, you can't contribute more, right?
Right.
So that's not the case. Some believe that if you contribute more than that, you're going to owe taxes. That's not the case.
Right.
If you contribute more than that, it's going to consume some of your federal estate tax credit, which most physicians will never need. In fact, I was interviewed by Medscape last week to comment on their upcoming physician well-being and finance. And they, in their survey, they asked the percentage of physicians, well, they asked physicians what their net worth was, and that's including student loans, house, investments, all that good stuff. And it was only like, I believe it was 15% or 11% of physicians had a net worth as a household of more than $5 million. And for your estate to be taxable at the federal level, it would need to be something north of twice that easily.
Right.
So, you know, consuming that unified credit is really not a big deal. Mm-hmm. The thing that kind of sucks about it is that if you contribute more than that, you really need to file a gift splitting tax return. And that's about $500 to have filed by the average CPA. Mm-hmm. I think that's $500 you don't have to spend if you kind of plan your gifts carefully.
That's right. Yeah. That's kind of, it's sometimes if the child's a little bit older, you can run into it. But at the end of the day, you're either paying $500 or nothing happens really.
Right.
I mean, it's just, I'm a little biased because I'm the college guy around here, but I love 529s.
Same.
They're so cool. I mean,
same.
There's so much good stuff about them.
Yeah.
Okay. This blends into the next question. How much does college cost? Get this question all the time, and I got it this week.
It's free if you're in the other countries.
Yeah. So I actually went and looked up, because we do this every year, looked up the prices of college. And so I got a list for you here. And then I got a bit of a scary story, but
fire away.
Just tells you to be prepared. So tuition, fees, room, and board. That's what I'm quoting here. In-state public, $28,000 a year.
Okay,
pretty close to last year.
This is average, right?
Average.
So if your kids are going to Alabama versus going to New York, there's going to be a swing in there for the cost of living.
Right. $42,000 for out of state.
Uh-huh.
And private is coming in at an average of about $57,000.
So once again, private is pretty much twice what public is.
Yep. So here's the story I want to tell. We have a family that has been preparing for private school for years. And I think a lot of times physician families will say, hey, we're preparing for private. And then they feel like they're done.
Mm-hmm.
Their college journey is over. They're totally prepared. Here's the thing. If you tell your child they can choose any school, right?
And rookie mistakes.
Yeah. And I think we're all rookies until the first one goes to college.
Yeah.
So this is like, they're learning.
Yeah.
But they, you know, give your child the pick of the litter. And generally I see them choose somewhere as far as possible from their parents. So for us, that'd be the East Coast.
Yeah.
And East Coast, they, it wasn't Ivy League. They just picked a private school somewhere on the East Coast and it was $90,000 a year.
Yeah.
So this is an average.
Yeah.
And your job's not over preparing for college just when you save money. We have to talk about this with your kids and your young adults as they're going into college about your budget. And,
yeah,
you know, a lot this family, I think, is going to be able to do it. But yeah, these are averages.
Okay. So this is, I want to share this and then I want to move on.
Okay.
So this is coming from the voice of experience, having watched physicians send their kids to college for the last two decades.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a couple kids in college too. So, something I see repeatedly is that in a family of two or three kids, the first kid goes wherever they want to go. And
yes.
Mom and dad will pay anything they want to pay. And it typically is a very expensive private school. The second one goes to the place that's in their backyard,
mm-hmm.
you know, their local state school. And the reason for this is, I believe, college is an experience good. An experience good is something that you have to actually live through to understand the value of. And with experience goods, people tend to equate price with quality or utility. So the higher the price, the more valuable they perceive it to be. And financial planning is an experience good as well. So this is, I know this. But yeah, so I, you know, you want the very best for your kids, but you find out that the very best is not the most expensive thing. In fact, the very best might be the school that they are fit for, that's easy to drive to, or where their friends are going, or where there's going to be a support network, or where there's more majors in case they can't pick the major that they, you know, they decide not to be an engineer and they want to be a biologist or something like that. So, yeah, I would say that the choice of where your first child goes to college is an important and often overlooked decision that, you know, in this case could cost $380,000. That's a lot of money in my world. So,
Yeah, their world too. Yeah. Okay. Next question's from a prospective client.
Okay.
And they asked, if I go with Physician Family and you manage my retirement investment accounts, how will you invest my money?
Yeah, this is a great question. And in fact, it's a real live question I got last week. I believe the person was coming from Pennsylvania. So so they asked if you manage it. So first off, when people come here, we require everyone to have a plan. So you got to buy a plan first. And the plan dictates what your asset allocation should be. Asset allocation is that mix of stocks and bonds, whether it's 50-50, 60-40, 80-20, glide path, whatever it happens to be. You want to start by looking at your high level asset allocation, because that's going to tell you what percentage of stocks and bonds to have in each account. Okay, so that's where the plan ties in. Second thing is you want to look at the taxability of the account. So, you know, if it's a Roth IRA, that puts you in a different tax environment than a traditional IRA than you would in, let's say, a joint, a trust, an individual, or another taxable account. So you have those three different tax environments for your investments, okay? And the reason I say this is you wouldn't want to put tax-exempt bonds into a traditional IRA, or worse yet, into a Roth. And I've actually seen people do this. They pay a lower yield because they're tax-exempt. You would not want to put high-yield bonds into a taxable account unless they're tax exempt, right? You wouldn't want to put world bonds into a taxable account, because then you pay ordinary income taxes, where those taxes would be deferred inside an IRA. So matching the tax environment to the tax nature of the investment matters. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the third thing to consider is where the investments are going to be. So we see physicians invest at Fidelity because they have the largest share of the 401k market. We see them invest at Vanguard because they're the cheapest. We see people invest at Schwab because they've been around forever. And we also see people invest at Betterment because they do a great job and they make the portfolio management process easy and cost effective. So, you know, where the money is going to matter, because, you know, if you're at Schwab, you have an incentive to get the Schwab funds. If you're at Fidelity, you have an incentive to get the Fidelity funds, and you have a disincentive to buy Vanguard open-end mutual funds. So some of the costs that you're going to pay vary based on where you're at. If it is Fidelity or Schwab or Vanguard or your John Hancock 401k, we give investment guidance about those accounts, which means you log into your account. You open the account, you set up a screen share with us. We look over your shoulder through the screen sharing window and we say, hey, click this button here to invest in that fund. And, you know, I'm not wild about that fund there, so let's reinvest. But it's click by click guidance. And I think we're one of the few firms that actually does that, because most firms really want to get that assets under management, that 1%. But we charge a level monthly subscription fee. So to us, it doesn't make a difference where it is. If it's an account like a joint taxable trust, IRA, Roth IRA, backdoor Roth, we tend to put those things at Betterment because we like the services that they offer. They make investing easy to stay and make the right investments. And then inside those accounts, it depends on whether it's going to be a traditional slash Roth or it's going to be a taxable account. So for taxable accounts, we will typically own municipal bonds in tax-exempt municipal bond funds, and then we'll own U.S. equities, international equities, and emerging market equities. And so we own those through exchange-traded funds. I'm not wild about doing business at Vanguard because the customer service seems like it has, I can just say I've experienced long hold times. I do like the Vanguard funds. And so we own Vanguard and Dimensional slash DFA funds in our client accounts that are through Betterment. then with, you know, traditional IRAs and Roths and those kind of things, we tend to own those same three sleeves of equities. Also, with world bonds. So you want some bond exposure, and as long as you're going to own U.S. bonds, there's no reason not to own international emerging market bonds as well. And we can cover all of those squares with somewhere between 4 and 5 exchange-traded funds, depending on the accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's the whole question. Yeah.
Yes.
The whole answer from beginning to end. The only thing that's interesting is that Betterment charges their clients a percentage of assets under management, but through an arrangement that we have with them, there's no assets under management for our clients in any accounts that we manage. That's all covered by the membership fee. So you don't have to think about how much is in there and the fees don't go up every time you put more money in.
Right. Yeah. I wanted to get to that too. I would understand the wanting to use a different brokerage for lower fees and no AUM fees.
Yeah. But really, we can help people with their money no matter where it's
at. Sure. Yeah. But the reality is that doesn't exist if you have a membership with us.
So. Yeah. True.
Okay. Similar question, but this is from a client of ours. He's a hospitalist here in Oregon. He asked, if my primary advisor, physician family, or any other team member for that matter, were to leave the firm for some reason. So get hit by a bus, leave, something like that. What should his plan be for their retirement assets at Betterment?
What do you mean? What should they change the way they invest because I died? Probably not.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is kind of coming on the heels of the other question. He is a lifelong investor at Vanguard. And you know, he likes Vanguard, at least he likes their investment options. And so the question is, like, am I going to be left high and dry if for some reason something happens?
Right.
So, you know, for him, we are somewhat of a backup plan. He knows Vanguard really well, but his non-financial spouse doesn't know Vanguard all that well.
Right.
And so that was the only reason I even really asked him to move it to Betterment. I thought that was a much better plan. I guess the other reason would be just to take it off his plate. He's paying for it. So,
So you're basically, you know, the calculus he's got to do is, how is my wife going to fare if I pass and my stuff is at Vanguard Group, you know, where they're the custodian, and leaving funds aside, right? Because you can get Vanguard funds anywhere,
right?
Not just from Vanguard. How's my wife going to fare at Vanguard versus how will she fare in the hands of physician family financial advisors? Even though they're a small group, you know, there's only 5 of us. What happens if they go away, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, So first off, I'm glad to hear the guy loves his wife so much that he's thinking about her all the time. I know that we're the backup plan for a lot of people. We're also the backup plan for each other. So if something happens to me, we have a backup plan for internal succession, such that other members of the firm would continue, right? Mm-hmm. So that's available. And you know, what's more likely than one of us passing is one of us taking a vacation or becoming ill. Mm-hmm. We went through this when Chelsea went on maternity leave. We still managed to grow the firm and continue to serve clients through the last quarter of last year while she was out on maternity leave, and actually, you know, transitioned the business through the Schwab shutdown at that time. So, you know, we went through that just fine. So being without a team member for, you know, 3 months or longer is part of our succession plan and is part of our SWOT analysis we run. So I'm not so much worried about that, though I think it's a concern. The concern I would have, and this is, so I was born in a Vanguard household, and I love Vanguard funds. But the reason I personally don't invest with Vanguard is because it's a maze. The phone tree is a maze. And I wouldn't want my wife to have to navigate that maze. So her funds are invested with Betterment. And I have confidence that she would be taken care of by the team in the event that I passed.
Right. Yeah, this is the power of having a team.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody understand that this client in particular and all our other clients, we all have an understanding of their house.
Yeah.
It's not just their primary advisor. So we have some, you know, what we call sort of institutional knowledge about every household here,
right,
and about investment strategy. And we would wrap our arms around this non-financial spouse if anything happened. There's one more sort of question I get from everybody and when they're deciding whether or not to move to Betterment. And it is, can I keep the funds I already have? It's a good, I mean, it's a scary question to think, Am I going to have to liquidate and pay a bunch of taxes?
No, no. But it's, so with us, if you, we have a lot of ways to handle things. So one, you could, clients could leave their money where it's at. You know, they don't have to move it. However, there's some place where they're being charged 1%. Sometimes we can just remove that advisor from the account and leave the money where it's at. If it's necessary for tax reasons or for some other technical purpose where it's in the client's best interest to leave the money alone, we'll do that. Right. We can shut off that 1% and still have the account run. Right. So that's one way to go. It's just leave it where it's at. Another way is to move it to a place other than Betterment. So we have other homes for money. But in the past, the distant past, in order to move to Betterment, you had to sell all your stuff and start off with cash. And that's simply not the case anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, we moved, 400 or 500 accounts last year from Schwab when they took over TD Ameritrade. We moved them from Schwab over to Betterment. And, you know, we had all kinds of securities in there. And the 99.9% of it went without any problems at all. And they accommodated the other pieces of it. So their capability these days is far greater than what it was in the past. Otherwise, I wouldn't go there.
Right.
But, yeah, you don't have to sell your stuff. And I mean, there are advisors who are, you know, they're charging 1%, and the threat that they're making is if you leave me, you'll have to sell your stuff. Or if you leave me, we'll sell all your stuff and you'll owe taxes. I just don't think that would fly in the face of SEC scrutiny.
Right.
And I think that's the mislaid fiduciary duty. So if that's what's keeping you from moving your money from another advisor to an advisor of your choice, or moving your money from there to taking it over on your own, don't buy it. They're just BSing you.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Next couple of questions about life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So the first question is term life insurance really the only life insurance I need? Ben, can I take this one?
I have a hilarious comment on this one, but yeah, you're welcome to.
Oh, my answer is yes.
And I would say yes, unless you're a doctor on the side and your major means of support is a farm that's been in your family for 100 years and all the rest of your family lives on the farm. And it's like a $20 million farm.
Oh, okay.
So I'm sure that one farm doctor's financial advisor who sold him a whole bunch of, you know, variable universal life is going to be sending his hate mail. Send your hate mail to podcast@physicianfamily.com. I will read your hate mail on the air.
Nice.
Yeah. Love your answer.
Yeah. Term life insurance.
Term life insurance. None of the VUL stuff. You don't need that.
Yeah. Okay. Next one is how much life insurance should I buy? And, you know, we actually have what we call the life insurance guide.
A guide for this.
Right.
Yes.
And if you email me at podcast@physicianfamily.com, I will send it to you, but I'll give my answer in here too. So how much life insurance you can get, it's a tough question to answer, not because getting there is tough. Getting to the number isn't all that difficult. It's just, it's not the same for everyone.
Right.
Okay. Personal. So there's no right answer. There's a wrong answer, which is not having any life insurance.
Yeah.
But the way you get to this number comes from a few things. You got to look at paying off your mortgage and your debts. So that should be covered in life insurance. That would be student loan debt, car debt, any type of debt you have, including your mortgage. You want to be able to take care of childcare and possibly private K-12 school.
Yep.
So imagine your life, you know, as a single parent, what are you going to need to pay for your children to go to school? And what kind of help are you going to need?
Right. And in this case, when you say, imagine your life as a single parent, that means that you're the surviving spouse.
Right.
And maybe you're a physician, you know, but maybe you're not a physician. Like how much money do they need? Right. That's the question that we're trying to answer.
Right. Yep. And then obviously you need to cover college. So a lot of times getting to the answer of that requires a plan. These plans a lot of times can help drive the life insurance conversation. And then lastly, we call that a lifetime income because it's not exactly retirement income because, you know, there's money that you need to have from life insurance that you would need to spend before you retire.
Yeah.
But you have an easy way to kind of calculate this, Ben. I think you said multiply your monthly cost of living by 400.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, that can be that right there. If you spend 10 grand a month, that's $4 million.
Yeah.
So if you are a fresh physician Like you don't have much assets built up. You could have several million dollars of life insurance.
Yeah. For younger physicians, I'm used to saying, you know, $3-5 million. For a mature physician, which is most of the people that we serve, they're, you know, people with, you know, a couple million dollars saved or $500,000 saved, they're further along. Their need for life insurance is less because they have more money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. And so we usually see physicians with sort of a laddered approach. As you save, some of your life insurance expires, and that's on purpose.
Right.
And then, you know, as you go along, you might get close to retirement with one policy, $1 or $2 million policy, because you have some cash and assets laying around.
Exactly. Someday you'll get a letter that says your 20-year term is up, your premiums are going to go up unless you take action. I'm like, hey, I graduated. Yay, yeah, I lived. Right. I've actually experienced that. I've gotten that letter. So it's a nice moment when you realize, hey, A, you live that long. B, you accomplished the goals that was going to cover. And C, you don't have to pay those premiums anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. That was the last question for today.
Fantastic. Okay. Listen, folks, if you have questions, feel free to put them on our answer line. You can call us at 503-308-8733. That number once again, 503-308-8733. Send a hate mail, comments, questions, and other good things to podcast@physicianfamily.com. Until next time, folks, remember, you're not just making a living, you are making a life.
Thank you for listening to the Physician Family Financial Advisors podcast. Are you getting all the tax breaks you really deserve? To find out, get your copy of the Overtaxed Doctor's Retirement Investing Checklist, available at physicianfamily.com/go.